The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. It's the show where the announcer, Todd Wilkerson, gets to say whatever he wants
before they tackle him and subdue him with large padded blankets so that Eric can prance onto center stage and pretend to be all sophisticated.
Although he's fooling absolutely no one.
And now, your phony baloney sandwich of a host, Eric Metaxas.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Todd Wilkerson. It's such a joy to be here today. As you know, this is the Eric Metaxas Show, which we say is the show about everything. By calling it the show about everything, I can talk about anything I like, really, which falls under the rubric of everything. Today, I get to talk to someone who is one – this is literally true, folks. Listen carefully. One of the world's best-loved authors. His books have sold more than 160 million copies. I, as an author – I wouldn't say this in front of my guest, but I am, of course, deeply, bitterly resentful of his success. 160 million books. Anything over 100 million is just showing off, and it's is ridiculous. So, but I'm sitting here in the studio with Ken Follett. You've probably read his books. You may have seen film versions of his books. He's here with me now. What an honor. Ken Follett, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Aren't you embarrassed by this success?
No.
All right.
I'm very
I just
proud.
Want a simple in the yes or no. I just want so you're not. He's very proud, very proud. But it's not an overweening pride. It's not hubris. It's just a healthy kind of pride.
Well, I hope so. Okay. I mean, I am aware that I'm only as good as my next book.
And you also are aware that it's a zero-sum game, so that the books you sell are books I might have sold. You understand?
You know, the great thing is that's not true.
I know.
So if you know, if
I'm a capitalist, not a communist. I know it's not true, which is why I can joke about it. But I just want people to be clear that you really have been outrageously successful. In 1989, your big book, The Pillars of the Earth, was published. And that launched you, into the life of writing fiction, of which most fiction writers would only dream. How many novels in total have you written?
I've written 31. The first 10 were not very good.
I've heard that, yeah.
And were not successful, didn't sell very well. So okay. Really, I've written 21. If A Column of Fire is successful, that'll right. be 21 successes.
Okay. All right. Well, so your new book, which is just out, is called A Column of Fire, and it is related to The Pillars of the Earth. Is that right?
Yes. The Pillars of the Earth took place in a fictional town called Kingsbridge, and they built a cathedral in the Pillars of the Earth. And then 200 years later, in World Without End, they lived through the Black Death, which was a terrible plague that killed more than a third of the people in Europe and the Middle East.
Yes, we've heard of it over here.
Okay.
You think Americans don't know these things? I realize that.
I don't think everybody knows these
okay.
things.
All right. Well, Ken Follett, I have to say, this book is a big book. Most of your books are big books, and most of your books sell tremendously. You've really written, you said, 21 since the first one, The Pillars of the Earth, kind of just broke into the world. I want to ask you, before we talk about this brand new book, A Column of Fire, what is it that led you to writing fiction? Were you always, as a boy, did you think someday that you would grow up to be a novelist?
I always lived in my imagination. So as a little boy, I was always a pirate or a cowboy or the captain of a spaceship. And it never occurred to me at the time, of course, that that was peculiar. But I became a journalist after university.
And where did you go to university?
In London, University College London.
Yeah.
And
you wanted to be a journalist while you were in college, university?
I wanted to be the editor of the Times. That's what I wanted.
Of the London Times.
Yeah,
the real Times. The New York Times, of course, is the fake It's the fake New York Times. The failing New York Times. But you wanted to be the editor of the London Times.
By the way, I think they're both great newspapers.
Well, you have to say that because you're on the bestseller list consistently. But I think that so you wanted to be a journalist. And what did happen after you graduated?
Well, I realized that I didn't love newspapers. I loved novels. And so while I was working as a journalist, I started trying to write a novel. And as I've said, my first effort was not a success, but my 11th was.
But see, this says everything. In other words, most people, after a few non-successes, would quit.
Well, those books were published. So I had some satisfaction. I had the satisfaction of holding a real book in my hand.
Yeah.
And of showing it to my friends and saying, this is my new novel. But I used to go into the store, and at the front of the store, there would be a pile, 100 copies of the latest book by Frederick Forsyth or Sidney Sheldon. And I would look for mine, and it was all the way down at the back of the store, and there were two copies on the shelf, spine out. And so
that's the spine out part that really gets you.
Doesn't it just?
A writer, as an author, when I just see it spine out, I think,
yeah,
blast them all.
Yeah.
How dare they?
But I used to think, okay, what do I have to do to get my book from the back of the store to the front? What is it? What is it that Frederick Forsyth is doing and Sidney Sheldon is doing that I'm not doing? And I began to see my books got better and better slowly, and finally I wrote a good one.
So you really studied the novelist's art?
Yes, I did. And of course, I've always been a voracious reader. I think all authors start off as voracious readers. And so I had already read hundreds and hundreds of novels. And I would think, okay, what is it about the ones that I really love? And I think that, by the way, the answer to this question is enchantment. What happens when you really love a book is you get lost in the story. It's like a magic spell. And somehow what's happening in the story seems more important than what's happening in the real world all around you. That's why it's a magic spell. It's enchantment. You're lost in the story. And that's what you have to create if you want people to love your books.
That's extraordinary. You're absolutely right. I don't know that I've ever thought of it that way. Of course, I've only sold about 1 million books, so what do I know? But seriously, you have the talent and you've had the tenacity to write these books. Anyone who's written understands it's quite hard work. Is there ever a point where you, as a writer, in the process of writing one of these many wonderful books that you've written, where you are lost in the writing in a way that would parallel the experience of being enchanted as a reader?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I think of it as being in the zone. And that's when the whole afternoon goes by without my noticing it. But at the end of it, I've got 5 pages of a good scene.
That's amazing. Now, have you always written historical fiction?
No, actually, I guess it depends what you mean by historical fiction. My first success was actually a spy story called Eye of the Needle, but it was set during the Second World War, which is not what we normally mean by historical fiction.
Right.
But it was set in the past, and it was set at a time before I was born when life, everyday life in Britain, was very different from anything I knew, because it was wartime.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was rationing, there were shortages, there was the blackout, and everybody felt that they were in danger all the time. So Eye of the Needle was the first book that I researched, and I found that really suited me. That really added enormously to what I could offer the reader in the book, the fact that I had learned a lot and could share with the readers a lot about what life was like for my characters in a particular period of history. That turned out to be something that I enjoyed very much. I enjoyed sharing it, and the readers enjoyed it too.
And who were the writers that you looked to as a kid, as a young man, that you really enjoyed? What novels did you enjoy the most?
Well, when I was 12 years old, I read my first James Bond story by Ian Fleming.
Right.
And of course, at that age, I wanted to be James Bond.
Right.
But it swiftly became apparent that I was never going to be 6'1", with ice blue eyes and a rather cruel mouth.
Uh-huh.
And,
well, neither was Sean Connery, and he pulled it off. Unbelievable. I think he's 6'4" with brown eyes. We're going to go to a break. It's a delight to be speaking with you, Mr. Ken Follett, the author of so many books. The most recent one, A Column of Fire, just out, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We'll be right back.
Love, lead. That's the heart of the student experience at Bob Jones University. Discover a university that's both academically challenging and spiritually encouraging. Learn from highly credentialed faculty who share your faith and approach everything from a biblical worldview. Be challenged to love God and others by getting outside your comfort zone and giving of yourself. Grow as a leader through opportunities on and off campus. Learn more online at bju.edu or call 800-252-6363. That's bju.edu or 800-252-6363.
Has Jesus been misquoted, and can we really trust the Bible? Find out in Fragments of Truth, a new documentary presented by Faith Life Films and Fathom Events in movie theaters nationwide for one night, April 24th.
How good are the manuscripts on which the New Testament is based?
Where did we find them? Where are they housed today?
Discover groundbreaking new research on the most ancient manuscripts of the New Testament and learn from the experts who know them best, featuring Bible scholars Dr. Craig A. Evans and Dr. Dan Wallace, and narrated by John Rhys-Davies of The Lord of the Rings.
Some have said that the text has been deliberately changed. We're going to look at the actual text that survived from antiquity, and we're going to talk to the experts who know best.
During this month before the premiere, we'll have the Bible scholars on my show to talk about the movie and their thoughts about making this movie.
We want to get to the truth of it, to separate fact from fiction, sober scholarship from sensationalism.
Get your tickets today for the one night only April 24th national premiere at fragmentsoftruthmovie.com. That's fragmentsoftruthmovie.com.
Wondering how you can make a difference with your cell phone? Check out Patriot Mobile, America's only conservative cell phone company. Patriot's mission is to provide a portion of their profits to conservative causes. You get the same great nationwide service as Big Mobile, transparent pricing, competitive plans, easy switching, discounts for active military, veterans, and first responders. All you need to know is their address, patriotmobile.com. That's patriotmobile.com. Patriot Mobile, built on conservative principles.
Hi, this is Rhett Rasmussen of BestHotGrill.com. We make the Solair infrared grills. Those amazing gas grills that heat up to over 1,000 degrees in just 3 minutes to provide professional chef quality performance in your own backyard. We have really thought out the design of our Solair grills so that if your tastes or needs change, you don't have to buy a new grill. All Solair grills are designed as a built-in so that if you buy one on a cart but later build a backyard kitchen, you merely unbolt the grill head and set it in the island. Solair Infravection grills have both infrared and convection burners. But if you later decide you want to change the configuration, you may do so, since the burners pop in and out without tools. And with their quality materials and construction, your Solair grill will be the last grill you'll ever buy. Learn more about these fantastic USA-made grills at BestHotGrill.com. That's BestHotGrill.com. Solair Infrared at BestHotGrill.com.
Your cell phone's connected to your tablet. Your tablet's connected to your laptop. Your laptop's connected to your Wi-Fi. 1 week link and thieves are in.
The digital world is so connected these days, it just takes 1 week link for criminals to get in. New LifeLock Identity Theft Protection now adds the power of Norton Security to help protect against the threats of today's connected world.
Your desktop's connected to your smart TV. Your smart TV's connected to your smartwatch.
Threats to your identity, like your info for sale on the dark web. And online threats to your devices, like ransomware. No one can prevent all identity theft or cybercrime or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but new LifeLock with Norton detects a wide range of threats to your identity and devices. And if there's a problem, our agents will work to fix it.
Your smartwatch is connected to your video doorbell. Your video doorbell's connected to your smart lock.
Join now and get an additional 10% off your first year. Go to LifeLock.com and enter promo code SMART. That's promo code SMART. New LifeLock with Norton. More detection, more protection.
Feel the cool breeze.
Metaxas, the Eric Metaxas Show. I am talking right now here in the studio to the famous, successful, best-selling author of so many books, Mr. Ken Follett. Ken Follett, welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thank you.
It's really wonderful to have you here. You really are a master of the form. I am not the master of any form. I'm the jack of many, but the master of none. You are the master of the form we call the novel. You said that your first experience was reading James Bond. Were you always drawn to that kind of fiction? Were you ever drawn to the classics, to Dickens? Or was it mainly books like those in the?
No, it was both. It was both. I always had quite a wide taste. In fact, around about the same time that I discovered Ian Fleming, I also discovered Shakespeare. And even as a young teenager, I would read the plays of Shakespeare as if the, just for the story, as if they were novels. Of course, I struggled a little with the language, as I still do with Shakespeare, but the stories were so strong that they pulled me through. So I had kind of a wide taste. But the thing about the James Bond stories that stayed with me when I began to try to write my own novels was my memory of the enormous, intense excitement I felt to have a new James Bond story in my hand to read. And what I wanted, my target as a writer, was that my readers would feel that intensity of excitement about a new Ken Follett story. That was what I was aiming at. That was what I wanted.
It's such an extraordinary ambition when you think of all the different writers and their various ambitions. And it's funny because, you know, writers maybe aren't supposed to have ambition until you think of Hemingway or Norman Mailer. You don't think of Dickens particularly as having an ambition. And yet, of course, to do anything well, you have to have some kind of ambition. But it's interesting that for you, it was equaling that feeling in the reader that you felt as a reader. I don't know that I've ever heard anybody put it that way. It seems to me that that has to account for most of your success, because that's exactly what your books do.
Well, I hope so. And that's certainly what I aim at. Of course, having said that very simple ambition, the way to move towards that is very complicated, yeah. And there are a dozen different things that you have to focus on as you're writing. But I do always keep that in mind. I always think about a reader, not a particular reader, it could be a man or a woman, old or young, but somebody reading this book and being lost in it and having such an intense experience with the book.
That never happens with Finnegan's Wake, does it?
Well, well. First of all, I mean, the first rule is clarity.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Joyce is a failure on all counts.
He certainly on the clarity area, then he has a little work to do yet.
But it's very funny because when people think of the ne plus ultra of, you know, literary fiction, they think of Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses or something like that, and they're effectively impenetrable. They're something else entirely. When you think of a novel by Ken Follett or a novel by Dickens, it's something else entirely. In other words, the story is most of what it is that you do, whereas yes. in some works of literary fiction, that's not the case. And I think that we're living in a time where that has been prized. Difficulty, obscurity has been prized over much. In other words, that many people of that ilk or who prize those things would look down on a Ken Follett, would say, well, your stuff is very popular, so how could it be any good? I mean, you must have had to deal with that.
Well, yes, that's absolutely true. But on the other hand, look, there are a thousand different kinds of novel. And you talked about Finnegan's Wake, which is exceptional because it's written in a made-up language. But if you think about Ulysses, although there's no story, it is a very intense and rich description of 24 hours in the life of the city of Dublin. And the characters and the events, although they don't actually form a plot, they still are absorbing and fascinating. And so it's not the way I look at it is just that there are lots of different ways for a novel to entertain people. I know what my way is. My way is to have a very strong story that draws you in so that you can't let go. But there are half a dozen other ways. I'm a great fan of Marcel Proust. He has no story. And he just follows he just has a thought and he follows it down a rabbit hole. You can't – I don't think you should make rules about literature. You should just enjoy what appeals to you.
Well, that's well said, and it's humble of you to say that. The book that I have in front of me here, this big book called A Column of Fire, what is this book about?
It's set in 16th century, and it's a story about spies and secret agents in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. And I got into this idea when I read that Queen Elizabeth I set up the first English Secret Service. And here's the link to James Bond, which I was talking about a moment ago, because what I thought was how intriguing it would be to have a story about spies and secret agents putting people under surveillance, tailing people, intercepting messages, decoding messages, doing all that stuff that the CIA does and MI6 and MI5. Only in the 16th century with guys in doublet and hose and Shakespeare beards.
Was spycraft developed to the level that it is today in the 16th century?
Well, a lot of the basic techniques were invented right then. There are differences now. It's more technically sophisticated. In the 16th century, for a message to go from Paris to London took a week. And now it takes less than a second. So from that point of view, it was very different. But it is fascinating how what they were basically doing, trying to find out other people's secrets,
right,
is essentially the same.
Oh, I'm sure, yes. And it's existed at least since, the 14th century BC, when you read, Caleb and Joshua, the spies that Moses sends into the land. I mean, this is something that's existed since the beginning of time.
Do you know, I forgot about that. You're absolutely right. There are spies in the Old Testament, in the Bible, yeah.
Yeah. You must read it again.
I did.
It's really a marvelous book. It has great sticking power. I understand it's still in print after so many years.
I have actually read it all the way through.
And I'm sure that even your books, having sold as many, have been outsold by the Bible. It's interesting because you think if the New York Times, if their list were accurate, the Bible would be number one, either in fiction or nonfiction, depending on what they think.
Your point.
But it really is an extraordinary thing. But of course, yeah, Caleb and Joshua were spies sent into the land. I've been reading the Odyssey lately. There were spies that it's just one of these things that. It's always been the case. But so you're writing about spies in the 16th century. The first sentence of your prologue is, "We hanged him in front of Kingsbridge Cathedral." What I noticed about that is you use the verb hanged and not hung. This is one of the things that drives me crazy. When I figure out what something's supposed to be, whenever people get it wrong, it drives me crazy. Many people would have written this incorrectly, would have said, "We hung him in front of Knightsbridge Cathedral," which would, of course, be incorrect. So can I first thank you for getting that right? It's the second word in your book, and you've already impressed me. It doesn't take much to impress someone of my level. But so then what is the story here, basically?
Queen Elizabeth I was public enemy number one in Europe because she turned England Protestant. The most powerful men in Europe were the King of Spain, the King of France, and the Pope, and they all wanted to kill Queen Elizabeth. So there were these assassination plots.
Now, excuse me. I have never heard this before.
Yeah.
This is extraordinary.
I've
just written a book on Martin Luther, but he dies in 1543. So the great wealth of my knowledge ends at 1543. Everything after 1543, I'm quite ignorant. So what a pity. But you're telling me that because of this they wanted to kill her. I have never heard this before.
And she set up the Secret Service to protect herself. And it was a success. It was run by a man called Sir Francis Walsingham, who played the role that is played in the James Bond movies by the character called M.
Yeah.
And Walsingham was a very smart man, a bit of a stiff-necked Puritan, but very clever. And he and his team of people smoked out these assassins, and they caught them all. And they arrested them, and they tortured them because that was what they did in the 16th century. And then they were executed. And Queen Elizabeth lived to the age of 69 and died in her bed.
Didn't she? Okay, folks, I am talking to the author, Ken Follett. The brand new book is A Column of Fire. I have heaps of encomia in front of me about Ken Follett's many books. The one from Publishers Weekly calls it, it's a sprawling novel, a fine mix of heart-pounding drama and erudite historicism. Holy cow. Publishers Weekly has never used the phrase erudite historicism before. This is very impressive. Folks, we're going to be back to hear more from Ken Follett. The book is A Column of Fire.
Someone's knocking at the door. Somebody ringing the bell.
If credit card debt has you down, nonprofit Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts into one easy-to-manage monthly payment, put a stop to late fees, and drastically reduce your interest. You'll pay thousands less than you originally owed. It's not a loan. It's a way to become debt-free and possibly improve your credit score. So call Trinity and talk to a certified counselor. They'll explain their proven program to you with no pressure, just practical solutions and hope for tomorrow. Are you ready to pay off your credit cards in less time for less money? Then call for a free no-obligation debt analysis and become debt-free for keeps. If your debt has you down, we should talk. Gather up your bills and call this toll-free number for a free, no-obligation debt analysis. Call 1-800-990-6976. That's 1-800-990-6976. 1-800-990-6976.
Freedom. One nation in all of human history was built on that bedrock. Ours. A republic of the people, by the people. And for the people. Self-government requires freedom, just as freedom requires an individual willingness to self-govern. Freedom has made America exceptional, but it can only last as long as you and I seek the good, as expressed by the laws of nature and nature's God. It can only last if you and I choose to act as people of character. Forging character has been the pursuit of Hillsdale College since 1844. Hillsdale College forges character and elevates civic discourse both on campus and nationwide. To find out how you can take their free online courses or receive a complimentary subscription to Imprimis, a monthly speech digest, visit hillsdalefreedom.com. That's hillsdalefreedom.com.
This is the Eric Metaxas Show. Of course, that's the theme from the James Bond movies. My goodness. I'm speaking to someone who admired the fiction of Ian Fleming, and it led him to a career of his own, writing many, many very, very best-selling novels, the most recent of which I hold in my hands, titled A Column of Fire, sitting here with Ken Follett. Ken Follett, again, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
It's just it's such a big book. Are all your books quite this big? Because people often criticize me for writing big books, but none of the books I've ever written has come close to being 900 pages, which is the length of this most recent one.
Well, you know what? If the book is good, people don't want it to end. So if it's continuously exciting and the story moves and changes and turns and there are surprises and all the things that we love, and people don't want it to end. And although it's common at the moment to say that modern people have a short attention span because a tweet is only 140 characters and spaces, and I've proved that it's not true. I've proved that if the book is exciting and you're enjoying it, you'll relish the fact that it's good and long.
You took the words out of my mouth. The only thing I would say is that publishers, and of course our mutual friend Brian Tart is sitting right here. You know, the question is, will the reader or the buyer pick up the book? In other words, if you have the reputation of a Ken Follett, they will, because they know they can count on you and they're not scared to pick up a 900-page book. But if you don't have that kind of a reputation, typically people would say, I don't know, that's too long, I don't know. You know, so it's a fascinating thing that your success allows you to write long books, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I think that's true. And part of the problem is that people feel committed to a book. So once they've started it, they feel guilty about not finishing it,
right.
Which, by the way, I think is a mistake. If you read 100 pages and you're not absolutely fascinated and having a wonderful time, throw it away and get another book.
You know, as an author, I agree. I don't care so much that people read my books as much as that they simply purchase them. Do you know what I'm saying? Because I have to put my kid through school. She doesn't get put through school if you've read the book, only if you've purchased the book. So anybody listening right now, I just want you to know, feel free to buy the book and not read it. You cannot read it as many times as you like, but just purchase it once. I think that's fair. Well, it's funny you say that, because that's happened to me many times. You read a book and you realize 100 pages in, this is not worth my time. I'm not enjoying it. But some people do have this guilt complex that I've got to finish a book once I've started it.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing entirely. But your books, it doesn't strike me that people are putting them down very much. Now, when it comes to being able to carry on a plot the way you do, this is fiction. I've not written fiction. It seems to me that it's a great talent that you either have or don't. This idea that, you know, you have some ability to spin these different plots. It's not just, you know, one story, but that you've got subplots and things going on and characters. How do you plot it out before you write? Do you plot it out? Do you use index cards and set out the plot? Or do you just, I mean, you hear often literary writers say, oh, I just go with it and I let the characters free, and which I think is nonsense. But what happens with you?
I'm a great planner.
Uh-huh.
And I spend about a year for A Column of Fire. It was a year planning and researching the book before I wrote chapter one. And I write, you know, it begins one day, I write down what the idea is for the book, and it might be a paragraph. And I think about it, and the next day I rewrite it again, and it's three paragraphs. The next day it's a page, then it's two pages, and it grows and grows. I ask what happened before, what happened afterwards, what are these people like, what else was happening, asking those questions, and it grows and grows. And after a year of this process, and, you know, if I'm planning something and I realize I don't know enough about a particular subject, a place, or a group of people, then I'll spend a day reading a book about it, and I'll come back to my outline the day after with fresh ideas. And by the end of that process, I've got an outline of about 50, 60 pages, which says exactly what happens in every chapter, what all the most important dramatic turning points are. And that is the only way I know to write a book which is constantly interesting, which never gets boring, which never makes you feel now would be a good time to put the light out and go to sleep. And I know that there are good writers. You were making fun, but there are good writers who say, I know the beginning and I know the end, but the bit in between is a voyage of discovery. It's not necessarily a bad way to write, but it's just not my way.
I think it's sheer laziness on my own part. The thought of writing 100 or 200 pages and then saying this isn't working is not something that I want to think of as possible. I think that that's – I don't want to waste – you know, some people say, oh, it's not a waste. I think it's a waste.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that – but I'm fascinated that you put that effort into planning it out. I mean, that's – really, that is fascinating to me, the mechanics of how you write.
Well, that for me, that is key to writing a book that will keep people's attention.
And I mean, it's the kind of book you write. They do keep people's attention, and they're rather complicated. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation on fiction, specifically the fiction of my guest today in the studio, Ken Follett. The book is A Column of Fire, brand new book by Ken Follett. Grab a copy. This is the Eric Metaxas Show.
Nowhere. People meeting people who can share.
Alvin, call me crazy.
I,
but no,
I'm
I didn't,
not going to do
I,
it.
I didn't mean literally. I meant, you know, Call me crazy, but I have an urge to talk about Relief Factor.
Okay, do it.
I take Relief Factor every day. The website is relieffactor.com. You can read about it there. But these are all botanical. So it's not like taking, you know, handfuls of Advil or different stuff that you get, which ultimately can be toxic. You got to be careful with that stuff.
Sure.
Some people take that stuff. They gobble it every day like M&Ms. Not good. Not good. Relief Factor is what I take. It works for me. When I stop taking it, the aches and pains come back. So that's kind of how I know that
it works.
Okay, so Harold from Massachusetts says, I was having awful back spasms when I went to bed, and then I heard about Relief Factor on the radio. It started working sooner than 2 weeks. My pain is so much better that I started using my back again and overdoing it, and I find myself running for Relief Factor again. See, every time, it's like, it's crazy. If it works, it works. Take it regularly. ReliefFactor.com.
Has Jesus been misquoted, and can we really trust the Bible? Find out in Fragments of Truth, a new documentary presented by Faith Life Films and Fathom Events in movie theaters nationwide for one night, April 24th.
How good are the manuscripts on which the New Testament is based?
Where did we find them? Where are they housed today?
Discover groundbreaking new research on the most ancient manuscripts of the New Testament and learn from the experts who know them best, featuring Bible scholars Dr. Craig A. Evans and Dr. Dan Wallace, and narrated by John Rhys-Davies of The Lord of the Rings.
Some have said that the text has been deliberately changed. We're going to look at the actual text that survived from antiquity, and we're going to talk to the experts who know best.
During this month before the premiere, we'll have the Bible scholars on my show to talk about the movie and their thoughts about making this movie.
We want to get to the truth of it, to separate fact from fiction, sober scholarship from sensationalism.
Get your tickets today for the one night only April 24th national premiere at fragmentsoftruthmovie.com. That's fragmentsoftruthmovie.com.
Your credit card companies love you. They love it when your cards stay maxed out. They love it when you only make minimum payments. They love it when you struggle. Why? Because they own you. And minimum payments mean maximum profits. Here's great news. National Debt Relief is now offering you free information on how to escape your credit card debt nightmare. If you owe more than $10,000 in credit card debt and are only barely making minimum payments, know this. You may not have to pay it all back. In fact, you may have the right to settle that debt for only a fraction of what you owe. National Debt Relief has helped thousands of people get rid of over $500 million of debt, and they're A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau. Get the information you need for free right now before this offer goes away. Call National Debt Relief now and escape your credit card debt troubles. 800-679-1288. 800-679-1288. 800-679-1288.
She seems happier. Her fur is so much shinier, silkier, softer. She has really mellowed a lot.
Sheba is 105 lean pounds of shiny, smooth, happy dog. For life.
The shedding has stopped. The itching has stopped.
Since 2001, we've helped more than 250,000 dogs get over their nutritional deficiency miseries.
And saved our customers bazillions in vet bills.
Everything we tried failed except the Dynavite.
Come to Dynavite for help.
DINOVITE.com.
If you want the dog to be healthy, you got to feed it something healthy.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Dynavite is nutrition.
Dynavite for life.
Don't let your dog itch, scratch, stink, or shed like crazy.
Come to Dynavite for help.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Hey there, folks. We're boogieing down here in the studio with Ken Follett, the master novelist. Ken Follett, it's one thing to talk about your fiction, but your life, many people wouldn't know it, but that you took a degree in philosophy from University College in London. philosophy. That's a major commitment to study as an undergraduate. What did you think at the time you were going to do with it, or were you doing it with the idea of going into journalism nonetheless?
I was brought up in a very religious family. And as a teenager, I had grave doubts about the religion that I'd been brought up in and grave doubts about the whole idea of God. And
when you say religious, when we think of Church of England, we don't really think of people who are very religious. It seems to be sort of more cultural. But this was a Methodist, or what kind of a
I was brought up in what would today be called an evangelical Christian sect called the Plymouth Brethren.
Oh my goodness!
Rather puritanical.
I'm very familiar with the Plymouth Brethren.
And of course, when you are in the process of rejecting your parents' most cherished beliefs, it's fairly traumatic. It's difficult for a young person to do, a young teenager.
Right.
And I thought that philosophy would help me make up my mind about all of those issues. And indeed it did. And, after less than a year studying philosophy at University College London, I was an atheist and still am.
And you finally discovered that drinking is okay.
And going to the movie, drinking. Yeah. Never mind drinking. Going to the movies was wicked when I was a boy.
I know. Isn't this terrible? We can't have that conversation. But so much of religion gets wrapped up in those kinds of rules and misses the point. It says that you have had an honors degree in philosophy, but unfortunately, honors is misspelled. There's no U in the word. You need to have that fixed.
Okay.
If you don't mind, I'm just trying to be a friend to you because this is going to be embarrassing you forever. It also says that you love music and that you are a bass guitar player in two bands. Sitting here, looking at you, you're very distinguished with your tie and your pocket square. I don't see you, playing with Foghat or somebody, for example. But you do love music,
And particularly the blues. I play the bass quite honestly because it's easier than the guitar,
right?
And what I enjoy enormously is being part of the band. It doesn't matter that I'm not a virtuoso musician, because so long as I can keep in tight with the drummer, and so long as I can keep the groove, the rule for bassists is you can, it doesn't matter if you mess up the tune, so long as you don't mess up the groove. So long as you're in the groove, you're a good bassist.
I never expected you to use the word groove in the short time we have together. I'm very impressed with your breadth. Do you see a connection between music and fiction, or is it something that you do as a break from fiction?
I think I mainly enjoy it because it is so completely different, because writing is so cerebral. You're thinking all the time and thinking hard and trying to keep a whole mass of characters and places in your head. And playing in a band is really totally sensory. It's very loud. I don't know why the guitarists always want to play so loud, but they always do. They just turn the amplifier up to 10. And there's a whole joke about they wish it went up to 11, because then they could turn it up to 11. So it's very loud and it's very overwhelming, and you just react to what the band is doing constantly. And I have a theory that there's a connection between the ears and the fingertips that does not pass through the brain. So you just go with the music.
Really?
And that's so different from writing that it's relaxing.
It's the difference between Nietzsche talks about Dionysian art and Apollinian art. And Apollinian art is cerebral and Dionysian art is visceral. And it's interesting because especially playing the bass and the groove, that's very Dionysian. But plotting and thinking the way you have to think to write something like this is the height of Apollinian, I would argue, but who cares?
I did not know that distinction. I really like that distinction. Thank you for telling me about it.
Very few people do. I was an undergraduate, and I remember reading Nietzsche's, what is it? It's a famous title, but it's something out of the Art of Music. I can't remember. It's one of his earlier works, but he talks about this distinction, and he says Apollinian is, if you think of a marble bust, right? It's rigid, it's perfect, it's all about form. And then you think about dance, which is where you enter into the art. That's more Dionysian. So you think of tribal drumming as opposed to sort of Greek art. And in the novella by Thomas Mann, Death in Venice. Those themes are there as well. I think I wrote a paper on it when I was 18, and it stuck with me my whole life. But I think that it's interesting because we all have a desire for both kinds of things, and you typically can't get them together. You know, they're two rather different things.
So how interesting! How interesting!
It's not that interesting, but thank you very much.
Well, it is to me.
So thank you. I understand that you were born in Cardiff, Wales. Can you tell us about the Cardiff Giant?
No.
All right. Anybody in the room, tell us about the Cardiff Giant. You're unaware of the Cardiff Giant?
Yeah, he may not have been there when I was
the Cardiff Giant. It's like Piltdown Man. It was a hoax, basically, around the turn of the last century.
Oh, really? Okay.
The Cardiff Giant. Well, since you're born in Cardiff now, you must know, but you must look this up. But the Cardiff Giant was a hoax.
Okay.
Pretended to be. I can't believe that I brought that up. But just every time I see Cardiff, some friends of mine a couple of years ago said, we're going off to Cardiff. And I asked them about this. They didn't know about it either. So I just every time I hear the word Cardiff, I feel obliged to ask somebody about it. Now, what do you do now that you've written this book? Have you already leapt into the next book, or do you take a rest for a while promoting this book?
I always tell myself that after finishing a book, I should take 2 weeks off and do nothing to do with my work.
And, 2 weeks, that's it.
But I never last 2 weeks. After about 10 days, I start thinking, now that could be a good story. I wonder if I could make a story out of that, and I'm back into that. And really, to tell you the truth, I don't really want to take a break from it because it's the most interesting thing in my life.
How wonderful.
Yeah.
How wonderful. Okay, well, we're going to be right back for a final segment with Ken Follett. The book, this brand new book just out, huge book, A Column of Fire. Stick around. It's the Eric Metaxas Show.
In New York City. Well, here I am, Lord, knocking at your back door. Ain't it wonderful to be
Americans in every tax bracket got a tax cut thanks to the bill signed into law last year. The economy is growing and Americans are feeling better about the future. And you've got more money to spend on what's important to you and your priorities. It's your money after all. Democrats in Congress who voted against the tax cuts are promising to raise your taxes if they win in November because they want your money back to spend on their priorities. Only you can stop them. To find out how much more money you'll be bringing home, go to taxcutswork.com now. There's an easy-to-use calculator, and it'll tell you how much money the new tax cuts are saving you this year and next year. Check your savings at taxcutswork.com and then sign a letter to Congress telling them to keep their hands off your tax cut savings because the money you're saving is yours. Go to taxcutswork.com, check your savings, and let Congress know you want to keep your savings. Go to taxcutswork.com. That's taxcutswork.com.
Dennis Prager here again, happily telling you about Relief Factor and my wife's knee pain that is gone because of Relief Factor. I'm taking it, and it lowers my pain as well. A lot of people have muscle or joint pain. Our housekeeper's husband couldn't work any longer because of back pain, so we gave him Relief Factor, and now he's back to work. Can I guarantee it will work for you? Of course not. But the majority of people who tried the 3-week quick start for just $19.95 go on to order more. Give it a try at ReliefFactor.com.
Have you heard of property tax lien certificates? Robert Kiyosaki and President Trump have written books on this double-digit fixed-rate investment. Don't outlive your money. Protect your savings from volatile markets. Invest in state-issued fixed rates. Call Cornerstone, a professional tax lien certificate investment firm, at 800-222-INFO. That's 800-222-INFO. Call 800-222-INFO or visit cornerstonetrade.com.
Watching you for quite some time, trying to find a way of making you mine. Long before you started coming on strong with me, with the super charm that brought me down to see. Hey, didn't you know that you've been acting like a movie
star? Hey there, folks.
Star.
It's the Eric Metaxas Show. I have the privilege of speaking with Ken Follett. He's here with me. In the studio, we're talking about his new book, A Column of Fire. Again, Ken Follett, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
It's a joy to speak with you. I want to ask you, this is one of these questions, when you're talking about historical fiction, how much of it is true? In other words, when we know, for example, that they wanted to kill Queen Elizabeth I. We know that. How much of the detail is true? How much is imagined? Because there's a continuum, right, between, you know, actual history and pure fiction and someplace in the middle, you know, where does this come out?
Well, my rule is that I must never violate history. So if there's something that we don't know, let's say that somebody committed a murder, but we don't know who committed it, and we'll probably never know who committed it, then I could have a fictional character be the one who committed that murder. But if we know who did it, then I couldn't make it my fictional character because that would be violating history. So I like to be able to say to the readers, everything you read of history in this book is true and is accurate. And, of course, I don't want there to be an obvious line because then that would the magic would go away.
Well, sure.
The spell would be spoiled.
Right.
So but I did put, if you look at the very end of the book, you'll see that there's a little section that says who is real. And I've made a list of the people in the story who are actual historical characters, because that's something that readers sometimes ask me. They sometimes say, yeah, but who are the real people? And so for the benefit of those readers who are curious about that, I have given the answer in A Column of Fire.
I have to ask you before we go, have you ever read the book Perelandra by C.S. Lewis?
Yes. It was a heck of a long time ago, but I've read most of his books as a teenager. Yeah.
I find his book Perelandra to be one of the most underrated works of fiction in the 20th century. And if the world hadn't gone insane, it would be taught alongside Milton's Paradise Lost. It is such the level of fiction writing, never mind the ideas. I mean, he was a brilliant man with ideas. But
yes,
the level of his writing in that book and some others so impresses me. I always want to ask people whether they've read it and they know about it. There are certain passages in there which I think are as good as anything ever written by Gabriel Garcia Marquez in terms of magical realism.
Okay.
Just virtuoso. And most people are unaware of it. But that's, of course, a very different kind. That's a sort of science fiction.
But now, do you know the Screwtape Letters?
Of course.
Isn't that brilliant?
You know something? Of all his books, he's maybe my favorite writer. That's my least favorite.
Oh, is it really?
Isn't that ridiculous?
I think so clever.
Well, no, it's incredibly clever. It's genius. But I somehow, when I go about 60 pages in, I just go, I'm done. I don't want to read anymore.
Okay.
I don't know. I've written parodies of the Screwtape Letters. I have. I wrote a review of the Da Vinci Code in the voice of Screwtape. And Screwtape adores the Da Vinci Code. It's probably his favorite book ever. And so I write in a Louisian, you know, parody voice praising the Da Vinci Code. But yeah, the actual Screwtape Letters, I don't know that I've ever gotten through them all the way. What are you going to do? It's sad. It's very sad. But you read them growing up. You were forced to. The Plymouth Brethren. What else was there to read?
I suspect.
They would disapprove of Lewis.
I'm not sure they would. I think they probably were.
Too much magic.
Too free thinking, too open-minded. They were very narrow.
Wow.
And but isn't it odd that they forbade me to go to the movies?
Yeah.
We didn't have a TV or radio in the house, but they never tried to censor my reading. So I bring home James Bond novels,
right,
and nobody says.
Little did they know you were sinning right under their noses.
But they probably didn't realize.
They didn't realize.
The whole, you know, James Bond's philosophy of life is about as far from the Plymouth Brethren.
Yeah, well, I would say so. That's why I don't read that trash, but I'll read your book. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ken Follett, thank you so much for being my guest. I'm so sorry we're out of time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. Folks, that's the program. Thanks for listening.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.